That we're going to begin with, and I want to start with a roll call. Regent Dennison.
Regent Bell.
Present.
Regent Brody.
Present.
Regent Hammonds.
Present.
Regent Hill.
Here.
Regent Milliken.
Here.
Regent Nichols.
Here.
Regent Spiller.
Here.
Vice Chair Thomas.
Present.
Chair West.
Present.
Regent Robinson.
Here.
Chair, we have 100% of the regents here.
Thank you.
We have a quorum.
Full house today, and welcome everybody. Welcome CJ on Zoom.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And we're going to start today with Academic Affairs and Region Health.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask Provost Fisher to come up. We've got 12 items on the committee agenda. So we'll try to go through them as fast as the law will allow. First item is approval of Master's of Science Applied Behavioral Analysis.
Yeah, before we head there, I'd like to say just a couple of things about what we have in front of us. There's three things I'd like to say. One is as you've read these and you looked at them, one of the really important parts of it is that there's certificates here, but they're stackable certificates. They go along with what would be degree programs, as well as can be used for additional degree programs across the university. So those silos that used to exist have been broken down and continue to be broken down and now move across that way. Two is if you looked at the cover sheets, what you can notice is in a large number of these, the discussion on budget has expanded because we have done a lot of work to tell people, please put in what you really need to be able to put these in and so that we can supply them with the money or people or that so that they can be viable into the future. And I think what they're in is even more exciting for me today, which is they're in areas that I see as a future growth and are areas that I think in a large cases we can do an awesome job in this state in those areas. So with that, I would love to start with applied behavioral analysis. I believe Corinne Murphy's on the line.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to assume you can hear me. So we are very excited about the new Master's in Science and Applied Behavior Analysis. This has been a very long journey, 8 years, to be frank, because we needed to establish a resource situation where we could support a brand new master's degree of high quality, high rigor, and one that would be very impactful for our region. So to echo Provost Fisher, this has been a great deal of effort to work into a program where we will be hiring two new faculty, both board certified behavior analysts, to join our faculty to establish a brand new degree program. It is 40 to 46 hours depending, and that depending really has to do with clinical supervision in the field. What sets this program apart from other behavior analysis programs is the rigor and the incorporation of supervision within the program itself. Many programs require students to engage in supervision outside of the framework of the program, and that's a challenge for those students in that program, and it's been a challenge for the field. And so the field of behavior analysis is one that serves multiple populations, including those with autism, developmental disabilities, addictions, and any number of other challenges that you could experience as part of your humanity. And so we are very excited to bring this on board. It does require a bachelor's degree, and it does require the full 40 to 46 hours in order to sit for the licensure exam. There is a licensure exam that is offered and conferred by the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, and that board will also review this program as a next step for accreditation purposes. We also have Ellen Casale in the room. Dr. Casale is a board-certified behavior analyst as well, and she may have some additional comments that she might want to add.
I will just add, this is very much a community need. As an anecdotal piece of evidence, we've had students reaching out. They can search that we are board-certified behavior analysts, both as part of the university and internally. So there's been a student demand as well. There's a very high community demand. So board certified behavior analysts have typically been understaffed across the nation, very much so. And so we see that exponentially rising. This particular program is going to prepare students to work with individuals on the autism spectrum and intellectual and developmental disabilities across the lifespan. And so that disabilities do not end when students graduate school age, and that is also a need in the community as well. So many BCBAs focus on that early intervention, which is very much important, but this program we have designed to prepare them across the lifespan as well, and have designed our clinical experiences to support that.
Thank you. Any questions or comments?
I would say this sounds great. Sounds like a very established need for it. And going back to your first question, first comments, the comment on, I've been here for a long time, we have multiple provosts in the past. One of the attitudes I've heard in the past from previous provosts was, think about the old Field of Dreams thing, if you build it, they will come, versus it used to be, if the students come, then we will build it. You have to prove that the students are in it, and then we'll put resources to it. And I think that created some tension within a lot of our programs that would build out and then leave it. What you described seems to be like kind of a mixture between the two. Show the land, before you let the program go forward. So when it, by the time it gets to the board, they've done demand analysis, you've done resource matching of what that will be. And we're not just going out on a wing and a prayer here, that we hope we get students, and then we'll put resources to it later.
Well, I mean, I think we have to do things strategically, right? And we all know higher education are in tight budgets, so if we're going to make decisions that are budgetary decisions as well as curriculum decisions, we have to do that strategically. And that means all of us talking about, does this fit what we are as an institution? Does it fit our mission? And then if it does fit our mission, how do we put it in, and how long will it take to get to there? And what's the real need in the
I'll add on to that. I do think it's a part of the different way in which we're approaching budgets, very much focused on return on investment analyses and being strategic. But most importantly, we now have strategic investment funds available to not just the institution, but to deans, so we can partner. So for example, I know there have been occasions where a dean wanted to hire a particular faculty member for a new program. Well, we said, as part of getting that off the ground, we'll match you one-to-one for a period of time, 3 years usually.
3 years.
And then at that point, you've got the enrollment necessary to make it sustainable. So those dollars come back to the strategic investment fund, and then they go back out and do it again. So it's a way to elevate the entire program academically using the budget.
And that's just what, if we see the need, desperately need the community, we want to make sure we're setting up for success.
Yes.
Yeah.
Speaking as a pediatrician, uses ABA therapists all the time. For some reason, right?
Right. Y'all need to speak up if you're over there.
You don't hear
me? We can't hear you.
This is a great program.
It's so great. I'd like to move that we approve this.
Is there a second?
Second.
Yes.
Second. All in favor?
Yes.
Aye. Motion passes. Next item is approval of digital health and data management graduate certificate.
Yeah, we have Dr. Lardy, Dr. Gregory Ellis Griffith, and Melanie Eaton speak on the program. Please.
Melanie has the flu, so
okay. Sorry.
We'll go ahead and start.
So good morning, everyone. I'm speaking now for the Digital Health and Data Management Certificate. And let me preface, our program is a healthcare administration program. So one of the things about healthcare, we know it's the largest sector of the economy, a multi-trillion dollar industry, but the healthcare sector is behind like banking and finance when it comes to IT diffusion. Still in some capacity, people still use faxes for healthcare, but that impetus has been pushed forward and healthcare is trying to catch up to the other areas. And that's what kind of spurred the need for us to also kind of invest in this digital health and data management. So we can look and say, okay, how is healthcare changing? Especially now, we have this influence AI. I was just in the workforce development meeting yesterday, and they were talking about how AI is changing the practice of healthcare.
how we used to do things one way, but up to like 2023, it's changed because AI started coming in and we're looking at, you know, things that are going to change within the next year or a year and a half with all these things that are going on. Our digital health and data management certificate tends to like tackle those needs by doing that. So this is a certificate that is stackable. Somebody who, a prize candidate for this type of certificate, it's probably somebody who's working in healthcare. They start to see the need as well, and they want to come back for that gratification in this data health and data management certificate.
Any questions or comments?
Well, this is an important area, and as a healthcare provider, I'm just regularly distressed by the $1 trillion, almost 20% of the national budget. And so however you can weave into this information that we can add some quality to the healthcare system and value and with a capital V. And I think AI and data has the potential to do that. It's a daunting task, but with the deficit doing what it is, a lot of that's from healthcare, and we are just sitting on top of a real epidemic when you look at young people today, and the loneliness epidemic along with the obesity epidemic is a combination that is really scary. So I hope y'all can weave that into the program and maybe we can do something really meaningful.
Any other comments? Motion?
Move we approve the certificate.
Second.
Motion is second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion approved. Thank you all. Appreciate it. Move on to item number 3, approval of health policy and systems management graduate certificate.
We're lucky it's the same group.
All right, so this is the health systems and management certificate. You teed it up for me when you viewing most of the things that you were saying. Healthcare is a multi-trillion-dollar economy, almost recession-proof. I mean, we did see with COVID that, you know, a lot of other places start to shrink, but healthcare was growing. When we saw with the recession in 2008, healthcare was still almost recession-proof. Larger sector economy is growing, and we see people who want to, you know, get a feel of healthcare. So in the past, you had to get degrees in order to do that. This certificate in systems management allows them to come and test the waters. You know, I keep hearing about healthcare. People think I need to get into healthcare. I'm probably ready for a career change, but I don't want to do that master's degree. It's too daunting having to be back in school. So what it allows is for people who do not want to get an MHA, or they want to get that exposure to go out and get the certificate. And the goal is, once you get the certificate, it's a graduate credential, and it can work, but you may say, okay, now I can do it. And now you may decide that you want to come back in and do an MHA.
Ditto.
Any other comments? Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you. Move on now to item number 4, sustainability graduate certificate.
Continue on.
And this is where you teed it off. You're talking about a multi-trillion-dollar industry in healthcare. So hopefully I can hit this one out the park. One of the things that we're focused on is sustainability. Environmental sustainability, financial sustainability, and just the focus on healthcare. Right now, as you said, it's 20% of GDP. Can we handle 23% of GDP? Certain things have to change, and we're starting to see that now. You almost see the creative destruction where we have these hospitals, and it's starting to change. Do we have the need for these types of hospitals? These discussions need to be had. We also know we have a very high quality healthcare system. One of the things I always tell my students, they can probably repeat it. You know, we have the highest quality healthcare systems in the world. People from all over the world come to study in the healthcare system, but it's very expensive. And many times is we've kind of forced money into the quality for certain islands of excellence, but other stuff starts to erode. So we need to start looking at that. And you're starting to see some of those things happen now. It was probably pushed forward most recently with the Affordable Care Act of 2016. We have the new budget that came out last year, and it's kind of changing healthcare, and it's starting to make us focus on the sustainability thing. How are we going to continue to sustain our healthcare system, keep it as it is, and improve it without eroding and trying to cover as many people as possible?
Well, this is something I do take exception with. We don't have the highest quality healthcare system. We may, if you need a hand transplant, get to Louisville, Kentucky, or some high-tech procedure, but the fact of the matter is we spend 90% of our healthcare dollar on chronic disease, and statistics tell us that of the 27 industrialized countries in the world, we rank last in something called a minimal mortality rates. These are deaths that could have been prevented before my age with good health care. So that's one of the perceptions we need to relay to the public, that we don't have the best. We pay twice as much. We have the best health care system in that if you're a receiver, but we don't get a better result. We pay twice as much and don't get any better results than anywhere else.
Yes.
So there's a lot of work that needs to be done here. And the fact of the matter is we pay for bad care. We're a disease management system. And weaving in all these programs, we need to educate people and educate the public. And they need to demand more, and we need payment reform. I'll get off my soapbox. Well, I think they have the opportunity to do something, but you got to educate people.
Thank you, Dr. Lane. Do we have a motion?
I move we approve this certificate.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you all. On to global economic issues. Undergraduate certificate.
Dean Thresher.
Sir, I think we all can agree that current events have brought a huge spotlight to the need for education and economics, understanding global policy, understanding how economies work on a national and global scale. And this certificate provides that opportunity. So it's built using courses that already exist in our economics department. And so the required courses come from there, and then there's an elective that comes from a wide variety of courses all across campus, including social work, political science, business courses. And the goal is to help our undergraduate students who are not majoring in economics have the opportunity to come away with just a more in-depth understanding of things like tariffs and inflation and federal interest rates and those sorts of things.
Any comments or questions? I'll accept a motion.
So moved.
Motion, is there a second?
Second.
Second, all in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you. Move on now to Bachelor of Science in Disaster Science.
Dr. Purse? Oh, it's going to be Dean Brown.
Yeah, I'm really excited today. Good morning. I'm really excited today to be able to present the Disaster Science program, both the bachelor's and master's. As you'll probably know, this grows out of our award-winning meteorology program, but builds on it in a new way. And many of you will remember that our students and our faculty served as the emergency management team for the International Special Olympics in the summer of 22, and since then have grown in experience. We've opened a disaster science operations center, and this program in disaster science has grown out of our experience. It builds on strength we already have. It builds in an interdisciplinary way, folding in public health, broadcast, leadership. And it's a unique program because there are very few disaster science programs around the country. And yet, if you think about need, hardly any day goes by that we don't see some need in the newspaper for disaster preparedness, for emergency management. And so these students will be learning how to anticipate disasters, knowing the science of how they evolve, how they develop. And so we already know that our students are going to be sought after by FEMA, national organizations, any large industry which needs to be able to plan for emergency. These are going to be students who are well prepared for it. And I believe that WKU is going to be a center for providing these students, not only to Kentucky, and any of you who remember our tornado, our torrential rainstorms know that we need this expertise, but the region, the nation, and really the world. So this is going to become, I believe, a really signature program for WKU. It's unique. It's already strong. We've been able to hire a new faculty member already who has hit the ground running, already has 12 grant proposals or more submitted. It's a flourishing program that I think is going to be a real strength for us for years to come.
Any questions or comments?
So we already had, we had certificates.
We have certificates in emergency management and disaster science. This is going to be a bachelor's program so that students can come in and get a fuller training. So the certificates are typically for people who are already working in the field to come and get extra experience. We're now going to become a big feeder for those people in the first place.
Okay, just looking at this, we have the bachelor's, then we have the master's next.
That's right.
So thinking about rolling the resources from certificates that are a little differently focused to this, how long, I'm looking at the plan here, how long do you think it'll take to grow those resources and be ready to meet this demand? Because you've got a good bit of demand forecast here.
Yeah, so we have a strong program already. And as I said, we've hired a new faculty member. We're building off of existing courses. We'll add a few courses, but we're ready to go.
Obviously, the certificate was popular, so you're expanding. Yes. So the certificate was popular, so you're expanding.
Yes, absolutely. And we see a lot of growth potential here.
Any other comments or questions? If not, I'll accept the motion.
Motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. We'll move on now to the Master of Science in Disaster Science. Same
excitement. really, we're not only going to take over the entry level of these sorts of positions, I think we're going to be training the high level as well. So this is going to become really one of our signature programs.
And if I could add on to what Dean Brown is saying, there is a group examining areas of institutional strength that we might consider exploring additional PhD programs after data science. And I believe this is one of the areas that is being considered for a number of reasons. Number one, because of the federal dollars available to support it. Number two, for the ability to create a unique program nationally for us in terms of not just teaching it, but building the research literature. And then lastly, it builds upon what is arguably the best applied meteorology program in the country, which is already a differentiator for us. So it's very much teacher-oriented.
No other comments or questions? I'll accept the motion.
I move we approve this Master Science and Disaster Science.
Submitted motion. Is there a second?
Second to Dr.
Bale. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you, Dean. We move on now to the Bachelor of Science in Environmental, Earth, Sustainability Sciences.
Still there.
All right. So the EESS, if you'll allow me to abbreviate it that way, is a growth from the APR process, our academic program review. And we found that our geological science students and our environmental sustainability and geographical science students had a lot of common interests. It's all about the earth and the environment. And so we realized that it's more efficient for us to combine these degree programs. We don't lose any classes, we don't lose anything, except we lose some extra reporting. So it's a slightly more efficient, but it also it's more efficient for the students because it gives them a better support because we're not trying to divide out two groups that really should be together. And so it's just, it seems like a natural move that follows on from our academic review.
Yeah, I think it gives them a broader approach too.
It does.
And I would also say I'm glad you mentioned APR. So academic program review, we put in about 4 years ago that every 5 years programs get reviewed both externally and internally. And these are the kinds of discussions that take place at the end of a two-day period that a group spends on campus looking at the programs. And it really has changed how we look at curriculum in a large number of ways. And this is a great example.
And I will say this was not a matter of the review saying you got to do this.
No.
This was the faculty in the programs looking at the review results and thinking, why don't we do more together? And so it's a more cooperative approach to these degrees.
Any questions or comments? Then I'll accept the motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passed. Statistical Data Science Graduate Certificate.
All right, so this graduate certificate is in support of data science in general because it delves into the statistical tools in depth that will be needed to support our data science programs. So we've already got some new data science programs. This will, as I say, support the mathematical underpinnings for those who want to specialize in the methods as opposed to the applications. And it can be built on in an advanced degree for data science, but it also can offer someone who's already working in a data intensive field better tools for their job. So we see this as both a partner in our data science PhD, our data science master's, but also as a standalone certificate that will be, you know, wanted by those who are in business already. Any data intensive fields, this will be very useful for.
Any questions or comments? If none, I'll accept the motion.
So moved.
Motion, second.
Dr. Rail, all in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item is the approval of Bachelor of Arts Integrated Advertising and Public Relations.
Dean Brown. The other Dean Brown.
Good morning, all. Now in his third year, the School of Media and Communication has brought forth a lot of innovation as it pertains to curriculum. It's our largest unit in the Potter College of Arts and Letters that we call PCAL, with approximately 700 majors and minors. Led by Angie Jerome and Ron DeMars, they have brought forth some nice innovation as it pertains to curriculum and efficiency and being sure that we're being good stewards of our dollars. Part of these efforts is now looking to integrate our advertising and public relations former programs that were Bachelor of Arts programs. What we're seeing now in industry is that those folks are working together more and more in one agency. And as we looked at our curriculum, we found out that they were too siloed in our approach. So I commend the faculty on looking at ways to find out how to find a unified core curriculum and then finding pathways for those individuals to explore the different disciplines in public relations and advertising. So born out of that is this new integrated program that we're very proud of. There will be more coming, but this is the first.
Any questions or comments? None.
Move to approve.
Motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Nice. Thank you, Dean Brennan. I guess you're staying for the other two, right? Next is approval of suspension of Bachelor of Arts in Art History.
Under Provost Fisher, we've had a lot of conversations about innovation efficiency, and one of his prevailing messages that I wholeheartedly agree is that, what are you willing to give up to get more? And I think that that's an important part, that at universities we hold on to things for so long and we forget that some things have shelf lives. The art history faculty have been great in saying that this is a degree program that we wanted to invest in. We did meet the enrollment minimums that I set for them, But we have faculty who have other interests and also student interests that's coming. So that faculty member and their team has decided to suspend the Bachelor of Arts in Art History. We still will provide education in those areas, just not in a degree program format. That faculty member now is going to be used more in our new Bachelor of Science in User Experience and also our animation. And we think that that's going to be quite beneficial in meeting those needs in those areas with the resources that we have. And I want to commend those faculty and staff to be able to make that tough decision.
Questions? Do you have any students currently enrolled in this?
We have a few, and then we will do the teach out program for that.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Thank you. Any other questions? Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Last item for actions, approval, suspension, minor in graphic design.
So graphic design was one of our minors that we had at one time that largely served the advertising folks and those in that major, as we find out that that major is now integrating public relations. So in looking at art and design, they decided that they wanted to put the resources towards the certificate in graphic design that has done quite well. So we are now suspending the former minor to make room for that certificate, which has more industry and workforce ready needs attached to it.
Questions? Comments? Is there a motion?
So moved.
Motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Sorry. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a comment about
please
this morning, because what we've seen this morning, I think, is a culmination of a lot of work over the last few years, not only our curriculum revision that we've done, getting things out of silos, having deans that work together cooperatively, and then it includes the RCM model of how we've done finances, and it's been a really nice example of all these comments and presentations we had this morning of, I think, a pretty healthy environment. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. I think we have an information item.
We do. We have an information item. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Mark Ciampa, who will be the person today giving us a faculty presentation. Mark is a professor of analytics and information systems and is the program director of the Gordon Ford College of Business Cybersecurity Data Analytics Graduate Program. Mark has worked in the IT industry as a computer consultant and has published over 25 articles and additionally books and 30 technology textbooks on that subject. And today we'd like to ask him to please come up and tell us a little bit about what would be cybersecurity and AI.
Thank you, Perla Fisher. I'm Mark Ciampa. I am in Analytics and Information Systems, and we're going to be looking at the force multiplier, how cybersecurity takes advantage of AI. We love to predict the future. Think of the power that gives us. I can look ahead to see what's going to happen, and then I can make plans today based on that. Of course, we predict the weather all the time, but there's so many other areas in 2026 that also we predict as well. Oops, there we go. The map app on my phone not only gives me the directions to get to my destination, but it also predicts the time I'm going to get there based on traffic, road construction, even the weather as well. Package delivery, I get the alert on my phone when that package is going to arrive on my doorstep so I can beat the porch pirates to it, right? In a large city, public transit is an app that is often used in order to assist individuals to know when the next train or the bus is going to arrive. In sporting events as well, there are a lot of apps and programs that fans and others use in order to predict the outcome of a sporting event and even athletic performance as well, individual athletic performance. Netflix is always predicting for me what the next best movie I should watch or song I should listen to. We did not have rolling blackouts in Kentucky, thankfully, based on the last ice storm. A lot of areas did, but again, that can be attributed to the utilities predicting what the demand is going to be. And of course, election results prediction there as well. And we could keep going all day long about the predictions that we use in 2026. But here's the question I'd like to pose. Is it possible for us to predict the next cyber attack, what it's going to be, and when it would occur? Imagine the power that would give us if we knew this next attack and when it was going to happen, and we could be better prepared for it. Is that actually possible to predict cyber attack? And the answer is yes, it is. In fact, we've been doing this sort of cyber prediction for upwards of 12 years or more. And with AI, it allows us to do even enhanced predictions of cyber attacks. There are basically two broad areas in which we predict in terms of cyber. One is to actually predict the attack itself. The other is to predict which of the vulnerabilities that exist the bad guy will try to take advantage of, or weaponize, if you would. A crack in the wall allows the cyber attackers to get in and do stuff. Which of those cracks, which of those vulnerabilities would they be taking advantage of? So we predict attacks, and we also predict vulnerabilities as well, which ones they're going to weaponize. One of these we found to be okay, but another one of these actually has much more potential going forward. So let's talk about these just very briefly. Here we go. We probably all are all too familiar with ransomware attacks. Hopefully none of you have ever been the victim of that, where your computer is locked up until you pay a certain amount through cryptocurrency to get it unlocked. That's really a common sort of attack. Recently, some researchers, there we go, looked at the predictions we had of ransomware attacks. And that is the orange dashed line over a period of time. Then they went back after that and they superimposed the blue line of the actual attacks that occurred over those times. And you'll notice a couple of interesting things. First of all, it's a pretty good match that where it's predicted it's going to dip, it actually did dip. Predicted it's going to rise, it did have a rise. But you'll also notice, too, it's not an exact match. So we've got some gaps going on here. And a problem with predicting an attack is that the cyber attackers can become aware of this, and they do a quick U-turn, and they change their attack from one format to another format. So I'm over here looking at predicting this attack that's going to happen, but the attackers have morphed it, changed it, so I don't see the new sort of attack. Sure. So instead of just predicting attacks, today we are more into looking at the vulnerabilities that exist and predicting which of these vulnerabilities in my hardware or software the attackers are going to take advantage of. A couple of numbers here, three numbers here. How many vulnerabilities are there? About 150 vulnerabilities. That is, a serious weakness in hardware or software is discovered every day. 150. We will probably hit 59,000 vulnerabilities discovered this year. And you can see since 2016, 332,000. To put this in perspective, this past week, Monday, was President's Day, and many institutions had a long three-day weekend. So imagine that a cybersecurity professional, Friday evening, leaves work and says, oh boy, I've got a three-day weekend. But when that professional comes back on Tuesday morning, they have 150 times 150, 150. They have 3 days worth of 150 attacks. They have 450 or 500 vulnerabilities that have been exposed or announced. Well, then the cybersecurity professionals have to start and say, how are we going to address these? Are we using this software? Does this vulnerability affect our organization? Who's using the software? What version of the software is there? How do we fix it? Now, you have to multiply that by 450 for that one day. And, oh, and by the way, another 150 vulnerabilities are going to be piled on that day as well. So, quite simply, in order to look at all of the vulnerabilities that happen and try to fix those vulnerabilities, It is an impossible task for an organization. It is just too much to handle. So what do we do? Well, instead of looking at 100% of the tasks that I, 100% of the vulnerabilities that I want to fix, what if instead we could whittle that number down to a much smaller, more manageable percentage that we then can try to address? In that way, then, I'm not looking at all the vulnerabilities, but I'm looking at a shorter subset of those vulnerabilities. And, oops, that becomes our area of prediction. Because if I can predict, out of all those vulnerabilities, the ones that the attackers are going to exploit, then it narrows down significantly the work that I have to do. And it goes from impossible to more possible. So, let's take, there we go. There are different metrics that cyber people use in terms of predicting. There's something called EPSS, too much detail here, but it's called a probabilistic predictor, that it looks at the vulnerability and it can accurately predict within 30 days if that vulnerability will be weaponized and used by the bad guys. Imagine the power then that gives us. There we go. We're able to produce charts like this so that when I come in on Tuesday morning after that long 3-day weekend and I've got 450 vulnerabilities staring me at the face and I'm challenged with which one of these do I then tackle first, something like this will tell me that one vulnerability in the upper left-hand corner has an 82.7% chance of being weaponized and used by the bad guy. Well, I'm going to then fix that one first. But if I've got another one that's only got a 1.4% probability of being weaponized, I'm not going to worry about that one. So this sort of data gives us that fighting chance in order to whittle down those number of vulnerabilities to a much more manageable role. Yeah, these are just a lot of the metrics that we use about predicting and in cybersecurity. Here we go. Okay. Yeah. So AI, of course, plays a real prominent role there in helping me predict what vulnerabilities are going to be exploited. There we go. But there are other uses of AI in cybersecurity as well, besides threat detection and analysis. There are things like security automation, phishing detection and response, incident response, and even security awareness and training, which is really interesting. Because AI can look at how you use your computer on a daily basis, and based on that, it can specialize training that helps you in terms of cybersecurity awareness, so that you're learning stuff that relates to your job role, whereas someone else may not need that same sort of thing. Here at Western, we have a master's in cybersecurity data analytics. And, there we go. The way I like to describe this is this. I went to my doctor recently, and I had to have my blood work done, you know, analyzed. Sure, okay. Well, there were two separate roles of individuals that had a role in doing my blood work. One was the lab technician, rolled up my sleeve. They took my blood, sent off to the lab. But then the result came back, and my doctor then had to analyze those results. In cybersecurity, we have two roles of individuals who work. We have the technicians who configure firewalls, or they might do stuff with antivirus software. But we also have to have the analysts who look at what the attacks might be, and then help the technicians with instructions as to what to do. Okay. So what we're doing in our master's program is we're equipping students to be the analysts, to not configure firewalls, but to look at a higher level of what the attacks might be so that then the technicians can be prepared for those. Yeah, so we do things like this. In fact, this is even a test question that I give my students. Given all of this data, which of these could be a predictor and which of them could not be a predictor? There we go. Yeah, so AI plays a very prominent role in cybersecurity defenses. But you might be thinking in your mind, well, what about the bad guys? How are they using AI? Well, it's really interesting to take a look. AI, which was introduced to the public back in 2022, the bad guys started to use AI right away. But they use AI the same way in which you use AI. That is, we use AI in order to make things better and faster. I'll have AI crafted email for me or something like that. Better and faster. Well, the bad guys were using AI in the same way. They were using it to make their attacks, their current attacks, better and to produce them faster. However, by the end of 2025, about 3 months ago, we started to see evidence that the bad guys are actually using AI in new ways, ways we hadn't seen before. So this opens up that Pandora's box about, well, what do we do about that? What do we do about how the bad guys are using AI? And that really brings us to the cliffhanger, because we're going to have to do a lot of work in determining how we can then prevent these bad guys from using AI in these novel new ways. So, I've talked too much, but let me toss it open for any sort of questions anyone might have. Good, there are none.
Okay. Thank you for coming to talk to us.
Sure.
I represent the student regent role, and so if you could talk to every student on our campus and you could like give them like a piece of advice, and forgive me, but maybe something beyond, like, given that this is like AI and it's advancing, but something beyond like, don't check emails from people you don't trust, and like, don't use like a fake password. Like, what advice would you have?
The one piece of advice that I would give, and I give this to everybody, and Shane Spiller has heard this spiel from me many times in the hallway, is protect your passwords. And that is, never repeat a password. I know none of you ever do that, right? Nobody has the same password on more than, yeah, okay, yeah. Make sure your passwords are long. But to do that, we can't memorize passwords. We have to use technology to help us. And there are things called password managers that allow me to put my passwords in there, they're securely stored, and then I pull them out when I need them. So my spiel is, and I do this to students all the time, is you need a good password manager. That's the starting point of security. Because once you feel secure about that, then you can move on to higher level things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
So what is it? So is that an app or something else?
There are apps that are available like that. There are things that actually are built into web browsers that have password managers. If you've got an iPhone, you've got one of those built in as well. So yeah, that's my starting point in terms of security. Is start with that password manager. Get control of your passwords, because that's a lot of the vulnerabilities that attackers will take advantage of. And if we can get control of that, then we're well down the road in being more secure.
So we only approved that program 3 years ago?
Two years ago.
Yeah, so how many students do you have?
We have between 25 and 30 students in the master's program, and then we have the separate certificate program as well. Yeah, so we're seeing a tremendous growth, and we see a huge growth from military people. That's kind of their mindset anyway, they say. And they just find this just a very attractive program for them to take that next step. Yeah.
So if, from the board's perspective, if we look at risk assessment, cybersecurity for the institution, what advice would you give us? What questions should we be asking? What, given our role?
Yeah.
given it's a college campus,
which has this unique set of challenges than a bank or, I'm a little reluctant perhaps because I have never asked Western's IT exactly how they use data analytics and AI in cyber, because I don't want to know that information, because once that information gets out, the threat actors use that then to say, oh, here's a defense, we're going to try to get around it. Yeah. So I've been reluctant to ask them. They absolutely do use AI and analytics,
to what degree, that would kind of be a question they would have to answer. My recommendation, we've had several other students in our program, in our classes, my recommendation is even to embrace this more fully, to jump in with both feet and look to see how AI can really be that force multiplier to help us today and moving forward about our defenses.
So this board's had a number of conversations about AI, and you and I have had a number of conversations about cybersecurity. As I was telling board members before you arrived, you've scared me half to death on multiple things. Your background is in a lot of areas. You got expertise in a lot of areas. Can you give us some thoughts on AI and where we're going? Given a week, 1 week ago, it was the CEO of Microsoft who said 12 to 18 months until all white-collar jobs are replaced. And that's one perspective. There's other perspectives. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that AI is a generational event. It is going to have a tremendous impact on not only education, but employment. You name the area, and AI is just going to be that force multiplier there. And I think it behooves us as an educational institution to really take the lead in terms of what students need to know and teach them how to use it respectfully and ethically, but not to avoid a conversation about it. I think the worst thing to do is to pretend like it's not there. The best thing to do is to meet it head on. Let's see how we're going to tackle this problem and put all of our energy for it, because it's not the future, it is the present. Anyone else?
I think I see why gold is $5,000 an ounce.
This is overwhelming.
It is absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
And I'll close with this, because Shane and I have also had this conversation in talking about what to do to protect yourself, like password managers and that sort of thing. AI is being used by the bad guys today for a lot of impersonation. Not only voice impersonation, but, you know, a video of a Zoom or something like that. It has gotten to the point that I have told my financial planner in Bowling Green, if you get a phone call from me or a Zoom from me or whatever that says we need to liquidate this position and move the money over here, I tell him, ignore it. The only time we make a financial decision is if we are sitting eyeball to eyeball across the table from each other. It has become that bad. So, yeah, there are a lot of things that we need to do, and AI is going to accelerate this, but I think we've got to get ahead of it, or at least stay even with it, I think would be the best approach. Yeah.
That actually sounds like it's creating jobs. You need more people at the bank.
There you go. Need more hands. Yeah. Anything else? Anyone? Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, it concludes our business. That kind of affairs.
All right. Thank you very much. Very interesting. Great presentation. We will move on to my